we're always telling people the problem is that just there's not enough stuff to go around. The problem is always that we can't afford it in some way. And they can point to financial metrics to say, you know, we'll run out of money is sort of the implication of a lot of this conservative policymaking. And for Keynes, you just say, you know, well, you're not going to run out of money. You can get the money from anywhere. The question is whether you're going to run out of resources.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. You know, one of the things that's crazy about, there's a lot of things crazy about the last 7 months, but I think it's fair to say that short of war, it's hard to think of an example of like major economies, quote, shutting down in the way that they have over the last several months. Like, it's really hard to find analogs. There have been financial crises. Those are actually fairly common throughout history. Even before there was sort of modern capitalism and central banks, that there would be sort of boom and bust cycles, and there would be massive spirals of panic, and people would pull back. And we've seen those happen before throughout, you know, for hundreds of years. We've seen contractions. We've seen like war and disease taking huge effects, but like mass shutdown where we're just a bunch of governments that govern billions of people are like, no, we are going to shut down the economy for the sake of public health is fairly new. And then the question becomes, well, what now? What do you do with the economic damage that you've caused? Right. And, you know, it's a rare moment in which basically no one's like, well, let the market go to work, because the whole thing's artificial, right? Like, it's not like there's some state of nature where, you know, my favorite neighborhood bar, like they made a bunch of bad business decisions and then they were shut down. Like, no, they just got messed up by the thing that everybody got messed up by. And then they got shut down. And now what are we going to do? And the we is like, what is government policy going to do for these people? And what it means is that, like, there's a famous line that I think of, which is a Richard Nixon line. I think he's announcing price controls at one point, or some huge macroeconomic intervention, where he declares we are all Keynesians now. And when he says we're all Keynesians now, what he means is we all believe, a la John Maynard Keynes, that proactive, strenuous management of the macroeconomy by the government can boost quality of life, actual economic growth, the productivity of a society, and actually absent that, things start to fall apart. That this sort of active management, this sort of active stewardship is really essential to a modern capitalist economy. And that idea sort of probably reached its crescendo in the U.S., weirdly enough, under Nixon, and then was rolled back considerably by the kind of neoliberal revolution that happens, particularly on the axis of Reagan and Thatcher, inspired by Friedrich Hayek, who's sort of Keynes's arch nemesis, I would say, kind of politically, theoretically and philosophically. And that reaches its apogee when Bill Clinton, a Democrat, says the era of big government is over, right? So you got the Republican Richard Nixon saying, we're all Keynesians now, basically saying the consensus, the hegemonic view is the view of the center left of macroeconomic management. You got Bill Clinton later on as a Democrat saying, no, the consensus hegemonic view is the view of Reagan, Thatcher, and Hayek, the era of big government's over. And then we have the financial crisis and now COVID. And I think increasingly there's no hegemonic view, but to the extent there is a hegemonic view, the one that's being built now really goes back to Keynes much more. I think the necessity of active macroeconomic management, the idea that like markets don't take care of themselves, and that there's actually nothing like unvirtuous or sinful about things like running deficits or putting money in people's pockets, those ideas are coming roaring back. And so you couldn't time a biography of John Maynard Keynes better than releasing one in the last few months. And Zach Carter, my guest today, wrote this biography. It came out amidst the pandemic. The book is called The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. It has gotten rave reviews from basically every reviewer that's set their eyes on it. It's astoundingly well written. I've known Zach forever, and he's a reporter at HuffPo. He writes on economic policy. I frankly didn't know how good he was until I read this book, which is really quite an extraordinary achievement. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Zach Carter to Why Is This Happening?
So great to be here, Chris.
Seriously, man, it's like one of those college quarterbacks. You're like, well, he's pretty good, and then he goes to the pros. You're like, what the hell? That's how I feel about your biography.
I really appreciate that, man. I mean, I've known you forever. And, you know, it's nice when someone who is already familiar with your work. All praise is always welcome, of course. But you know, when someone who's familiar with you says that. But that was also my wife kept saying that to me while we spent a lot of time both writing books at the same time, sort of editing each other, and she was like, this is way better than what you do for your job. You know, are your bosses going to be mad?
Well, it's a funny thing, right? I feel a similar version of that. Like, you write for Huffington Post, I do a Daily News show, and I think we both have kind of, you know, deep intellectual questions we want to wrestle with that the day jobs we have don't really let us do that, you know, in the same way. Right. This is like, what is it? A 600-page biography of Keynes and his worldview.
Yeah, there's no Keynes and his worldview vertical on HuffPost anymore. They got rid of that a couple years ago, I think.
Well, so let's start. I mean, I want to start actually before we get to his ideas. I mean, what I like about the book is that it really situates him as a human being in a certain milieu, and also treats him as a moral and political philosopher as much as an economist. So let's just start with like who this guy was. He has a quirky, weird, fascinating, entertaining, bizarre life.
I was frankly shocked by what I learned when I was researching his actual life. I came to Keynes as a result of the financial crisis. So I was a banking reporter at a small trade publication in Central Virginia. Everybody I talked to in 2006, 2007 just kind of took the virtues of rational markets for granted. Not in the sense that they would, you know, bring it up with me like, hey, Zach, did you know that rational markets are cool and stuff? It was just understood. It was like, that would have been like saying 2 + 2 = 4 at a conference of mathematicians or something. Everybody in the financial world just knew that markets were good and government was inept, potentially catastrophic. And then 2008 happened and all those people were saying, well, we need a bailout. And we also need a fiscal support package. Otherwise, the global economy is going to collapse. And I think they were right about both of those things. And I think they were right to change their tune. But I started reading Keynes thinking he was going to be this guy who was like the people I was talking to, a trader, an economist, someone who thought about numbers and productivity. And that was not the case at all. He spent most of his life as a philosopher. He kind of backed into economics by accident. He doesn't have an advanced degree in economics. He only studied it for a few weeks at Cambridge as an undergraduate. It happened to be the case that at the time Keynes was writing and trying to exert influence over public policy in the world, the economics profession was sort of on a new and unique at that time upswing in public power. People would pay attention to economists in treasury departments and central banks in ways that, you know, previously it hadn't really mattered. The profession really developed as we understand it today on the back of the ideas that Keynes put forward later in his career. So he spends most of his time with these artists, with these people like Virginia Woolf, with these painters who are hanging out with Pablo Picasso in Montparnasse. He's connected to post-impressionism and realism and all of these literary realism and all of these movements that are happening between capitals in Europe and also New York in the United States. He eventually marries probably the most famous ballerina in Britain, who's a Russian immigrant named Lydia Lopakova in 1925. So he's just this bon vivant kind of art fanatic, frankly. Who also loves thinking about the nature of the good and the nature of truth and whether truth is something rational that people can intuit directly or something non-rational that has to be understood emotionally through expression and perception. And the fact that this guy ends up in economics, which is a field that I think of as being, frankly, just, you know, there are plenty of good economists out there, but it's not something most people think about as fun
or as entertaining. I mean, also, like, they're real, like, economists are real squares,
right?
As a general rule.
And I honestly think part of this is why Keynes sort of gets forced out of the profession in the 1970s. Everybody knows that this guy is just so much cooler than they are.
He also, I mean, we should just be clear, like, this the crew that he's running with, or this sort of bohemian Bloomsbury group or whatever,
yep.
Like, this sort of bohemian group, like, he's You know, they're all sleeping with each other.
Yeah.
He is, before he marries his wife, the ballerina, that he's sort of in that group kind of out as gay. You know, he dates men, he sleeps with men. Like, that's his deal. And I think in that world, it wasn't crazy. It was a fairly, like, bohemian and hip group. But
most of the men in the group were gay. And when some of them would settle down with women, it was sort of like, huh, what an interesting strange arrangement that a man would settle down with a woman. I mean, it sounds enormously stressful to me, frankly, like the sex lives of these characters.
Yes, it sounds stressful to me too.
As they're having like long-term committed relationships for, you know, years, and then just, oh, by the way, I slept with your best friend last night. It was great. I would like to invite her to the next party. And people have to sort of, they have this creed where they're deeply committed to this sort of, you know, kind of free love ethos. And you have to agree, oh yes, that's okay. And so long as everybody's open and honest about their feelings, it's, you know, everything's supposed to be all upright and good. And of course everybody is like constantly riven with jealousy and rivalry as a result. But I think in a way, this is a very different kind of stress, but like I really hated rowing crew when I was a freshman in high school. I just really hated it. It was awful. It was really hard. But I think because it was so difficult, I felt super committed to it in this way. And I felt really bound to the other people who were doing it because it was so unpleasant. And I think all of that, that sexual and emotional tension that was going on between these people really bound them together in a way that made them committed to each other in a way that I think other ordinary friends would have just, right, you know, cut ties.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It did have, like, in the book, it sort of comes across there's something intriguing and extremely dynamic about it, but also, like, cult is the wrong word, but it's intense. It's, like, very, it's a very hothouse atmosphere that he's in. And talk a little bit about his class profile, like, you know, the UK is a very class stratified society, and his own class profile, I think, is relevant as we sort of go on to how he's making a living, first of all, and how he sort of comes to view the world.
Absolutely. I mean, Keynes, in short, is well-to-do, but not that well-to-do. He's the son of an academic at Cambridge named Neville Keynes, who's in the economics department, and really makes his name more as sort of an administrator. He's not someone... There's no Keynes before Keynes in the history of economic thought that anyone will ever teach you in an economics course. They have a nice house with a couple of, you know, paid servants in house. So it's respectable English middle class, but they also are interacting with the British upper class all the time. And Keynes can feel that social distance as a young man. And he goes off to Eton, which is this very, very prestigious, fancy private school for, you know, it's basically the British version of high school. And from Eton, he goes to Cambridge, and he just totally excels at these places. And so he learns how to move within the upper class very early. And I think there's a bit of desire on his part to sort of ascend into the elite out of the middle class and into the super rich. But he's always sort of seeing himself as a defender of middle class British values. And I think in the United States, we have a definition of the middle class, which sort of includes, at least today, just absolutely everybody. Yes. No one wants to identify as anything other than middle class. But in Britain at the time, I mean, this means people who would sit around and read books and have enough money to think about it, to have the time to sit around and think about reading books, who would go to the opera now and then, maybe not, you know, every week, but who were aware of the cultural happenings in different parts of the world, but who were not just people who had inherited so much money that they never had to work ever. There are people who felt, in Keynes's case, you know, who needed financially to, but also felt a moral obligation to work on behalf of society, not just to revel in their own riches. And this is very much the profile of most people in Bloomsbury. It's, you know, Virginia Woolf and her sister Vanessa Bell. They inherit a house. So they have a place to live. They don't have to make a ton of money, but they do have to make some. So they're able to make a career, as in Vanessa's case, as an artist, as a painter, in Virginia's case, as a writer. But they're not super rich. For a long time, Virginia is ultimately dependent on Keynes to maintain her career financially, because Keynes is basically paying Virginia, not basically, Keynes is paying Virginia's husband, Leonard, to be an editor for a newspaper that Keynes owns. And that's the money that's keeping the Wolves afloat while she's writing these brilliant novels that aren't actually making any money. Eventually, of course, she becomes, you know, fairly well-to-do as a result of her own success as a novelist. But it's a world of people who like to, you know, knock off in the middle of the day and drink champagne while they get their hair cut. And, you know, this is happening. There's not a lot of interaction with working people in any capacity other than the, you know, they have servants in their homes, right? So they have a cook who prepares their meals and things like that. But it's a very class insulated world. Once Keynes makes it to Bloomsbury, he's not really interacting with the elite anymore the way he occasionally would when he was at Cambridge. He's talking to middle class kind of bon vivants and artists and people who are in a certain way, their privilege is the status of their wealth, but they're also outsiders as a result of their sexuality. So the fact that there are so many gay men in Bloomsbury gives it a sort of outsider status. And then also the fact that there are so many women who are doing things that are ordinarily reserved only for men in British society at this point in time. You weren't supposed to try to be a serious intellectual if you were a woman in Britain in 1912 or 1908. So this is the world that he's coming out of. And in a lot of ways, it's the world that he's trying to preserve at the beginning of his career as an economist. And I think later in his career, it's the world he's trying to make, he's trying to realize for everyone.
Yes. That point to me is so, it comes through in the book really interestingly, and I think actually is such a great way of thinking about Keynes and in some ways thinking about the highest aspirations for, you know, social democracy or democratic socialism, depending on which line you are, but just like a world in which like the circle of people who can have a kind of Bloomsbury life is just like basically everyone.
Right? You're
like,
right.
But like the idea is that like rather than this, you know, and there's the famous Marx line about, you know, a poet in the morning and a hunter at night, a fisher.
Right.
But the idea that, you know, a vision of a world in which this kind of degree of comfort and time to do things like sip champagne in the afternoon or write or think is actually the thing that we want to democratize, as opposed to a privilege that is going to stay in one little group. And the confidence, I mean, you know, we'll get to this later. Keynes writing about the economic, you know, what our grandchildren's economic life is. Mm-hmm. And Keynes is quite confident that's possible, that could be our future. Here we are in the future and it's not our future, but it's interesting to me that class profile and the experience of that kind of bohemian comfort and is actually like ends up being sort of a central model in some ways for the vision he ends up crafting.
I think he's kind of possessive about that lifestyle early in his life and as even into his early 30s. I don't think he becomes optimistic about the economic possibilities for our grandchildren until he's been studying economics for a while.
Right.
And economics, I mean, the thing about economics at this stage, you know, you talk to an economist today and these people are completely certain about how the macroeconomy works. There are rules, there are trends, there are principles they can cite that say this is how things are. This is not the way economists saw things at this period in time. Economists were people who debated basic principles about what they were even doing. I don't want to smear all economists today because there are, of course, very many creative, intellectual, deep thinkers in the economics profession. But when you take an Econ 101 course in college, they tell you this is how it works, right? And they give you charts that show you how it works. This was not the way economists thought of things when Keynes was becoming an economist. So he could say, well, hey, maybe this is the way things are, or maybe this is the way things are. And he eventually came to see, after managing the British economy he was in charge of British war finance in World War I. So he really saw the economy from a kind of top-down view as a manager of the British Empire's entire economy. A war economy in 1914 in Britain was not like the modern American. You know, we've been in endless wars for, you know, a lot of people listening to this podcast. We've been in wars their entire life. That was not what happened economically in Britain in 1914. The entire economy was basically being run by the state for the purposes of the war. And Keynes could see, okay, here's how this sector interacts with this sector. Here's what happens when we have a shortage of wool. Here's what happens when we have a shortage of copper. You know, it's not just that we can't make enough guns. You know,
we are so far from the world of state planning in any way. Basically, you know, as you described, England in World War I, there's lots of economies like this. Like, there's like a room.
Yeah.
Like, well, how much wool is England going to produce? And how much of this metal do we need to get so that we can make all these mortars? Well, we got to make these many mortars. So let's back out the, like, yeah. There's like a bunch of people figuring out like what the economy will be.
Yes. And you know, I don't think Keynes wants that for, I know Keynes does not want that for a peacetime economy. He doesn't even really want it for a wartime economy. He's very uncomfortable with his role. He's a pacifist in charge of British war finance who is morally opposed to the war and formally, in fact, files a letter of conscientious objection to the war, even though he is, you know, probably the most important person for its continuation because of his economic insights for the way that the whole thing is being conducted. But Keynes, after doing all of that, he says, well, look, all the stuff that we say about markets, I mean, you know, that's a nice idea, but it doesn't necessarily work, right? And we also know that, you know, if you have specific goals, like the state can accomplish those goals without a market. It's not impossible. And this makes him uncomfortable because he's very committed to these ideals of Enlightenment liberalism about freedom of conscience, about you know, individual liberty. He very much thinks of himself as someone who is coming from the Enlightenment liberal tradition. And yet he's becoming quite comfortable with a much more expansive role for the state, and eventually comes to believe, I think, that those ideals about freedom of conscience and individual liberty really can't be realized in a democratic society unless the state takes a more active role in management of the economy. And that is an insight that he develops over time. It's not that he comes to the table. His social vision is always there, but his insight about what is possible and how broad that social vision can be applied, how much of the population can participate in it. Once he learns more about how the economy actually works, he comes to believe, like, we just let everybody do it.
Well, what's fascinating about him, which I think you do a good job of tracing in the book, is that he does not come from the left. He does not come from like a tradition of collectivism, of trade unionism or sort of, he's a Enlightenment liberal individualist whose lived world is about bohemian individual choices, there are, you know, at this time, obviously there's huge, you know, there's already been the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. There are various versions of socialism and anarchism, you know, stalking their way across the continent in all kinds of ways that draw on these much more sort of collectivist, you know, sort of anti-liberal democracy, solidaritaristic traditions. He's just not at all part of that. Like, and that's not the world he's coming out of, even though he ends up in a place, with a sort of philosophical economic vision for a mixed economy that has, I think, a real powerful, you know, prioritization of equity.
No, one of his intellectual heroes from a very early age is Edmund Burke, you know, the father of Enlightenment conservatism. I mean, I think most people would place Burke within the broad liberal tradition, but the father of conservatism as we understand it in Anglo-American politics, I think. And yet Keynes, by the end of his career, is the financial architect of the National Health Service. He's literally the guy who puts together the plan that socializes British medicine. And he doesn't see any contradiction right between these things.
We'll be back after this quick break. Let's talk about his first, I mean, he has this job for the government sort of managing the war economy. And then you know, his breakout moment as I think a thinker, certainly as an author, is his experience in Versailles. Mm-hmm. The war ends, you know, people probably know this, but to the extent you don't, England wins, and everyone is, furious at Germany for, you know, again, this was the most horrible thing that had ever been visited on human beings, World War One. I think at that point, the carnage is just incomprehensible. The both the human toll in terms of deaths, but also starvation, disease, the flu pandemic, mental trauma. Obviously, the term shell shocked comes from that period. You have just tens of thousands of young men who are basically have been driven insane by what we would now recognize as PTSD with no actual like treatment for them, no ways of dealing. I mean, the specter of disaster and horror. And basically, you know, the Allies are like, we're going to make you pay, Germany. And you know, Versailles is where they sort of hash this out. And Keynes is watching this all play out with increasing misgivings and then panic, if I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
What is, describe his experience there.
He enters the negotiations at Paris for the Treaty of Versailles with a very deep sense of optimism. He has been carried away by the vision of Woodrow Wilson and Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. And I think to most liberals in the United States today, Wilson is famous for being like a really horrible racist. But at the time in which he was, but at the time in Europe in particular, Wilson was regarded as this figure of almost sort of like divinity by pretty much everybody across the ideological spectrum, but especially on the left. There were communist newspapers who were talking about what a hero Woodrow Wilson was because he had put forward a set of principles about how to end the war and about what the world should look like after the war, which was about self-determination for nations. It seemed to be an anti-imperialist blueprint for the future. And so if you believed that the war was caused by imperialist aggression, whether it was from Germany or from the UK or from whoever, then what Wilson was putting forward was an end to that aggression. And so there were a lot of people on both sides of the conflict who thought, including Keynes, who thought this was an opportunity to end centuries of brutality. And Keynes was a just totally inveterate optimist to a point of, I think, delusion at times. But he comes to Paris thinking, we can do this. We can end imperialism and begin a new age of democracy and international harmony. And instead, he sees people squabbling over territory and using money as a sort of means for imperial aggression at the conference. So he writes this book called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, which is absolutely scathing, just absolutely scathing. And it is shocking to the world because he's detailing the negotiations and the sort of underhanded negotiations of his own government. He is the top official from the British Treasury at this event. And he is saying our prime minister and our central bankers who were here did things that were unconscionable that are going to set this entire continent up for war. And the second half of the book is really not about numbers and financial analysis, but about what he thinks will happen when those numbers take root in other countries, about what people in other countries will think when they see their governments shipping off, you know, would today be, you know, billions, maybe even trillions of dollars in war debts or reparations to other countries while people at home are, if not starving, struggling. And he's like, this is going to make people angry at other countries. It's going to make people angry at foreigners, and it's going to fuel authoritarianism, and it's going to create a demand for strongmen, not only in Germany, but certainly in Germany, but across Europe. And it's an incredibly bleak document. There's no other book like it. I mean,
it's like the most prophetic thing anyone has ever written on the most high consequence, like literally on the highest stake question, maybe in human history, which is the Holocaust, World War II, like, he publishes in 1919, right?
Yep. Yeah. He blitzes through it in a couple of months after leaving.
20 years before Hitler crosses into Poland, he nails it. He said every step in the domino chain of causation, he walks through in the essay.
Yeah, yeah, it's very clear, and I mean his numbers are solid. There have been attempts to take down his financial analysis, which I don't think hold water. I mean, you can read there are a series of sort of libertarian publications that have published. Actually, Keynes was wrong about the numbers in the treaty, but the numbers I think hold up. And you look at what happens politically. I mean, you don't have to actually go all the way to Hitler. I mean, Mussolini is taking over in Italy in 1922. I mean, you have the right. Beer hall putsch from Hitler in 1924. You have all of these right wing death squads that are out across Europe in the 1920s. And it's really, really clear that this thing is a disaster very quickly, but it's not clear before Keynes writes that book. When the treaty is signed, everybody wants to hail it as a victory for Woodrow Wilson and the future of anti-imperialist democracy all over the world. And the left gets behind it too. So it's not just conservatives who are excited about this at the time.
I had sort of forgotten this and I've read a fair amount about, I think I've read more about the war than about Versailles actually, or the war's end, but I had forgotten how much it's a sort of two-faced situation where everyone's so war weary. There's a kind of victor's justice. Wilson, I think actually genuinely wraps it all in this kind of wrapping of anti-imperialist, collaborative, like the war to end all wars, peace, League of Nations. We're going to now work together collaboratively to help people find self-determination. And then underneath the headline are just this like brutal regime of austerity the conquered people that, and so Keynes's book about that is puncturing a thing that is a widely hailed myth at the time, that this is like a net, like a win-win net victory for the world.
Yeah. And I mean, your point about Wilson being sincere, I think is important. Wilson he does not come across well in the economic consequences of the peace. Keynes has these very compelling character sketches of the major presidents and prime ministers who were negotiating there, and Wilson just comes across looking weak and bamboozled is the word that really sticks in the press when people are reviewing Keynes's book, and Keynes is kind of he's kind of taken aback by how negatively people respond to his portrayal of Wilson, because he says, look, Wilson was the only guy there who was actually trying to do good. Everybody else was basically a thief. and Wilson was trying to do good, but most people would rather be thought wicked than stupid. And that line, for whatever reason, has always resonated with me. Now, Wilson, there are all sorts of problems with Woodrow Wilson, as we've alluded to earlier, but in this moment, in particular for Europeans who are still at the end of World War I, it's very clear that the United States is on the ascent, but the places you go for intellectual legitimacy, those places are still in Europe in 1919. You still want to know what people are saying in London. You want to know what they're saying in Paris. You don't necessarily go first to New York and see what the intelligentsia there is up to, although people are starting to talk about what's going on in New York. And that shifts as the United States ends up being the short-term beneficiary of the terms of this agreement, because it's not just Germany who is saddled with these terrible reparations that forces it to be dealing with this awful austerity for so long. It's also the victorious allies who are saddled with these huge war debts to the United States. So one reason that that the UK, for instance, insists on these brutal reparation payments is because they have these debts they have to in turn make pay off to the United States. So all this money is just being sucked out of Europe and going straight into the United States. And that is really the fuel for what we now call Wall Street. I mean, that's how Wall Street comes to be an internationally significant center of financial power. And so long as Wall Street is continuing to then lend that money back out to Europe, it's not necessarily a problem. But Wall Street's not always willing to lend that money back out to Europe.
So you've got, right, so you've got this sort of austerity regime, you've got war debts. In Keynes' personal life, the book is an enormous hit. Bestseller, massive hit, translated. It also has the like frisson of the guy who was in the room. I mean, it's yes. Sort of a scandalous account in some ways, yes. Right? It has this huge news-making quality to it, aside from like its sort of, you know, theoretical penetrating nature. What is the sort of period in Keynes's career from then to his big masterpiece, The General Theory?
What's remarkable about Keynes is that he is held up after his death as this brilliant guy who reinvented the field of economics, who was able to perceive insights about how the world works that nobody else had been able to perceive before. And he's used as this sort of legitimizing figure, particularly in Democratic Party politics in the United States, for about three decades after his death. But during his life, he loses just about every single policy battle he's engaged in. And he engages in every single one that matters in Britain from really from the beginning of the war until the end of World War II, until the end of his life. He starts winning policy battles during World War II, but he is basically telling the world, we have to renegotiate this treaty for most of the 20s. And then when it's very clear that they're not going to renegotiate the treaty, he says, well, we'll basically have to end the gold standard. This thing does not work. The system of international trade and monetary management that we have is fueling further austerity and is making all of these pressures, that these economic pressures that he thinks are creating and fomenting authoritarianism, making it worse. It's exacerbating the problems that were created by the treaty. And so we have to start managing money in a different way. Early on, he's kind of what we would call, I think, today a monetarist. He's somebody who's saying, look, we need to manage money to ensure a stable price level because we're having this horrible deflation. So let's make sure that we stabilize prices, but we don't have to do, you know, we don't have to do big things about messing with markets or with public works or deficits or things like that. He doesn't start talking about that until the late, very late 1920s and the 1930s. But no one does that. The gold standard continues to just tighten and tighten the vice on all of these countries that are struggling to in a lot of cases to feed their people. I mean, we were having famines in different countries throughout the 20s, even in the United States, which is having a boom in the 20s. There's an agricultural depression that lasts the entire decade. So American farmers, the Great Depression for American farmers doesn't start in 1929 with the stock market crash. It starts in 1919 with the end of the war.
Let's stop and do a little like sort of hard money monetary policy 101 here, right? So the money supply in an economy, my favorite metaphor is basically water in a field, right? Like you want enough, you don't want a drought. So you need enough water that the crops grow, but you don't want a flood. Because that could also do it, right? So like, and the role of central bankers, to oversimplify all this now, is to basically fiddle with that little, the switch on the hose so the fields are getting, they're getting enough water, but not too much. That's, again, I'm massively oversimplifying. The reason I'm using this metaphor is that under a system of hard money with a gold supply, like the amount of water is fixed.
Only so much.
There's literally an amount of gold. Like there would be an amount of water. And so you look at the crops, you say, no, we definitely need 100 gallons. And they say, sorry, there's just 50 gallons of water in the reserves. And then you just have to say, well, a lot of the crops died, a lot of people starve. So Keynes is looking at a world in which this artificial standard, which is that the amount of money that is in your economy is equal to the amount of the gold you hold in reserves, which is a totemic, powerfully idea, he is watching it create misery and basically saying, if we literally just overturn this idea that all of you have, that like the amount of money circulating around the economy has to be connected to this block of metal, we could just honestly like invent affluence. We could just like magically out of thin air make things better and people stop starving. The key insight is that a bunch of kind of bad ideas people are holding on to are causing actual tangible misery and poor economic performance.
Yes. And it's very clear to people who are capable of examining the actual data. And it is hard to get data at this point in time. It's not like today where you can, you know, they don't have Google Finance, right? But people who can examine the data can just see that this thing is causing misery. And they have a very clear intellectual understanding for why they think there's not enough money in the economy, and as a result, people can't buy things, so their standard of living is falling, and they're basically right. Keynes comes up with, I think, a more sophisticated understanding of why people's standard of living falls. He says, you know, deflation doesn't just make it hard to buy things; it causes unemployment, which is a really critical theoretical insight that he makes at this point in time. you know, when people talk about the gold standard today, it's well understood that the gold standard is sort of an instrument of conservatism and the right. And that wasn't true when Keynes was attacking it in the 1920s. This was something that everybody believed in because everybody believed in it as a sort of symbol of progress, that like enlightened people in a democratic society wouldn't let, you know, avaricious governments control their currency, right? You would leave that up to the people, to the economy to do.
Right.
And so there were very progressive people who saw what Keynes was talking about and thought it was shocking and terrible. And they didn't, not only did they not necessarily understand what he was saying theoretically, they didn't want to believe it for reasons that would be politically confusing today. And so he has a very hard time getting the world to go off the gold standard. It really doesn't do it until the gold standard basically destroys the world with the Great Depression and World War II.
So let's talk about the general theory and move maybe into the sort of intellectual history. And, you know, this is something you're very good in the book of sort of explaining Keynes and concepts fluently. So what are the sort of core insights of the general theory? Why is it such a big deal? What are the core? He lays out what we then come to call Keynesianism. Like, what are the core insights? What does he get right? And what are the effects?
So I think the most important thing for most people about the general theory is that he invents macroeconomics here. He says, look, there's a difference between studying individuals and their decisions in a marketplace and looking at the economy as a whole and what is going on within that economy. It's a huge, huge breakthrough. Things will not just naturally work out because people are making free choices in an economy. You need someone to manage it. And that becomes clear when you look at the economy as a whole. So the field of macroeconomics is created out of the general theory. That's an extraordinary achievement independently of everything else that's in there. But I think the other achievements are much more important. Until the general theory, the key concept in economic theory was scarcity. And we still teach that in Econ 101 today, you know, that economics is the study of scarce resources and unlimited wants, or limited resources and unlimited wants, something like that. There's the basic idea is that there's not enough stuff to go around to satisfy all of the desires of everybody, so we have to economize with them. The very idea of what we call the social output of our society is economy, to do more with less.
Right.
And so that's what economics is. Keynes, by 1937, has come to believe that scarcity is not the thing. There is enough stuff to go around, to at least to meet a certain standard of living. And he believes that within, you know, two generations, there will be so much stuff that we'll only have to work 15 hours a week to have a decent standard of living. And the numbers do add up there. There's a distributional problem, though, that didn't quite work out.
Right. So
he says instead, the key issue here is not scarcity. It is uncertainty. We do not know what is going to happen tomorrow. And so our decisions about what to do with our resources today are they're hard to make. It's hard to say what a rational decision is in this moment. What does it mean to rationally maximize your income when you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day or the next week? And Keynes was living in an era of sort of cascading crises, you know, whether it was the outbreak of World War I, or Britain going back on the gold standard and having a massive, just sudden 10% unemployment surge, the Great Depression. These are just huge calamities. And if you're an investor, say, you have no way of knowing in 1920 at the end of World War I that this stuff is coming. If you put your money in a factory in Germany or a logging enterprise in Canada, the way that these shifts in the political winds can change things, you have no way of accounting for. And if you're really honest, you never know people look at historical trends and charts and data all the time, but no one really knows what is coming. And I think pandemic.
No one in October 2019 knew that 3 billion people would be in shutdown in April of 2020.
Right, exactly. This is exactly that kind of uncertainty moment that Keynes was talking about. And he said, you know, what you need to do in order to manage that macroeconomy correctly is to take into account the fact that people don't know about the future. And that means that governments will have to play a role providing certainty to people. Now, there's only so much the government can do. I mean, if you take uncertainty to its sort of logical extreme, it means you can never know anything, right? Maybe your government will implode. Maybe we'll be invaded by Martians. You know, you can come up with these different sort of crazy scenarios. But the idea is that the government can manage uncertainty in ways that individuals and private businesses cannot. And if the government manages that uncertainty, you are able to have a system in which a somewhat private economy can continue to function. Now, I say somewhat private because Keynes, at the end of the general theory, says we're going to have a somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment for this to work. And by somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment, you know, he's not talking about exchange-traded funds and the stock market. He's talking about the stuff that businesses spend on when they are building new factories or doing new research, that sort of stuff. He doesn't define that, but later in his career, he thinks it's about 2/3. To put that in context, the United States spends about 20% of GDP on government spending. So we're at about 1/5. He was talking about basically tripling that.
Wow. Yeah.
It's quite a bit. I mean, he was a flexible guy. I think he would have looked at, you know, probably would have thought that, you know, he could have gotten by with less, but certainly more than we do now. So he's talking about a very serious program of government management. But he also thinks that you can do that government management without ordering around the individual things that human beings are doing with their daily lives. You don't need to have a Soviet state accompanied by that level of investment. And he thinks it really, if you want to avoid something like the Nazi system or the Soviet state, you will need to do this investment, because otherwise you will have chronic unemployment. You will have a situation like the Great Depression, and that will be the normal state of affairs in the economic world.
You know, the idea that worries about of the future, uncertainty, produce cycles of self-accelerating spirals, right, of disinvestment that he calls them animal spirits, quite famously, but mm-hmm. These kind of collective panics that can seep in that then have real world effects. The government can kind of come in and use its power to be like, no, we're not panicking. We're right. not pulling back investment. We're not pulling back spending. You guys all think that things are going south, so you're going to do that. And by thinking that and doing it, you will bring it about. There's one player who can come in here and say, nope, not happening. And there's a lot of evidence to say that's true.
I mean, the classic example is the example of hoarding, that like when things get really bad, it's not just that people don't spend money. They didn't put it in a bank. They just, during the Depression, particularly when banks were failing, people would keep money in their socks and under their mattress. And this meant that, you know, my spending is someone else's income. This meant that there was not economic activity happening. And I'm sure we're seeing quite a bit of that now. It's a very normal human reaction. And until people feel confident that tomorrow is going to be better than today, they're not going to want to go out and buy that, you know, certainly not splurge on luxuries. Everything's a necessity until you're out of money, right? Then you find that you can cut back on things. But, right. but a lot of things expenses and costs that we took for granted 6 months ago, I think a lot of people are not making right now. And so Keynes says, well, look, if the government just does the spending, it doesn't have to buy those things. The government doesn't have to go out and just say, all right, well, I'm buying a bunch of guitars because the market for guitars is down. But it can pay people to build bridges. It can pay people to fix highways. And at the time, that was extremely controversial. People said it was socialism to do these big road building projects. They freaked out about it. And indeed, when Keynes was advocating these public works programs, and a fascinating thing for me about studying him was that coming to recognize that he was advocating these big public works programs for years before he came to the general theory. The general right. theory was sort of the eureka moment. Here's why I like this policy program yeah. that I've been advocating for 10 years.
That's my favorite kind of theorist.
Yeah. I mean, and he was honest about it, right? I mean, he changed his mind a couple of times about what his sort of underlying economic philosophy was. And when he would change it, he would say, look, people here know that this is my favorite policy remedy. It's public works. Well, I've changed my mind. Now here's why I think it works.
Right.
which, yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine a public intellectual admitting error today, I think.
Well, he's got one of the all-time great quotes about mind changing, right?
I don't know if he actually said it, but I couldn't find evidence for it when I was doing the book. Yeah, he's credited with, it's something like he's a
when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do?
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think he actually said it. He may have, but I couldn't find evidence for it. But he's the kind of guy, though. If you read the general theory, most of it is incomprehensibly dense.
It really is. I took economic consequence of the piece. You can read. But the general theory, you can't.
It's horrible, and I think that's why it's part of its power, though, is that people can say, like Keynes said in the general theory, and no one actually knows what's in there. So you can credit it with anything. And there are parts of the book that are not totally consistent with other parts of the book. So, there's a Keynes that you can take out of that book that is saying, you know what, let's just have the Federal Reserve be, you know, a little bit more aggressive with managing monetary policy. That's an interpretation. You have to ignore like 2/3 of the book to make that interpretation. But when he has those sort of stray asides, they don't sit in they do sit in tension with the rest of the book. People who interpreted it became the people that we associated with the name of Keynes. So in the United States, in particular, Paul Samuelson's textbook, it's called Elements of Economics.
Yep.
Became the way that we understood Keynes. And Paul Samuelson has none of these sort of other philosophical concerns that Keynes is addressing himself to. He's just trying to reverse engineer through economics. Paul Samuelson is a guy who very much agrees with the sort of classical economists about scarcity and doesn't agree with Keynes about uncertainty. And so you get a particular version of what we now call Keynesianism that becomes dominant in the United States. That sort of sands off all the, potentially radical things about that book.
Well, I want to talk, maybe that's a good place to sort of go sort of for the final part of this conversation, which is like, there's two things that struck me. One is the sort of political philosophical vision, which is that scarcity is actually an illusion. And that there's a possibility of broadly shared affluence, if we get this right. And what I think is so interesting about that is that it's both, it has opponents on both the capitalist right and the Marxist left. I mean, the sort of contention of the Marxist left is like the deprivation you look around when you look at capitalist society is inherent to the system. That's what the system does. It produces misery. The system isn't broken. It's working, right? And the capitalist right says, right, well, those people aren't working hard enough, or they don't have the human capital, they don't have the skills, their wage is being set in a market that matches supply and demand, and so they don't have money, or they're poor, or there's a big catastrophe. That's just the market sort of raining down its judgment. And Keynes says, no, you're both wrong. Actually, you can actually have a mixed economy that does have private markets and also does have like broadly shared affluence. And it's, there's still something taboo about the idea. There's still like, the most Keynesian intervention I've ever seen in my life was the Democratic Party jamming that $600 unemployment insurance bonus, into that CARES Act, which they did at the last second. And a bunch of Republicans freaked the F out about it. They almost voted against the bill. It was just the most like simple, beautiful policy intervention I've ever seen, I think, in my life. It was just like, everybody gets an extra six. You lost your job? Extra $600 a week. And it worked. Like, it saved 10 million people from poverty. People's disposable income increased during the lockdown. People's personal savings increased year over year. It saved businesses because demand did not go away. Like, and it was just like, to me, it was a perfect example of like, wait, can you do that? And that's the power of Keynes. It's like, there's this kind of taboo around scarcity of like, wait, can you do that? And Keynes is like, yeah, you could do that.
Yeah. And I mean, he's somebody who witnessed the power of the productive system as a war manager, right? So he saw in World War I, like, holy crap, we can just do this. I mean, the UK before World War One, GDP went up like 25% over the course of World War One for the UK. It was not in a recession beforehand. It hadn't been in a recession for decades. But World War One, suddenly the economy was just producing things that were unimaginable, even to Keynes, who was, you know, become this, you know, really important optimist. He was in fact constantly recommending to war managers at the time, you know, economies just don't go this hot. We're going to have to cut back somewhere. We don't have the resources. And they would turn out to have them. So he saw this incredible productive potential of the economy. And he said, you know, the problem is not that we can't produce enough. Like we do produce enough. And that creates a real problem, I think, for the economics profession, at least the sort of, again, I don't want to, you know, smear all economists, but for the economics profession that's had power in Washington for the last 30 or so years, because we're always telling people the problem is that just there's not enough stuff to go around.
Yeah.
The problem is always that we can't afford it in some way. And they can point to financial metrics to say, you know, we'll run out of money is sort of the sort of implication of a lot of this conservative policymaking. And for Keynes, he just say, you know, well, you're not going to run out of money. You can get the money from anywhere. The question is whether you're going to run out of resources.
Right.
And you can just see the United States. I mean, we just had this situation where we were not only were we paying these people $600 extra a week, the economy was in terrible shape. We weren't even very, we were less productive than we've ever been because the economy was shut down and we could still afford it in this sense.
Right.
So I think that intuition from Keynes is for him, it becomes almost like a religious faith. He just believes in the power of our collective affluence. And when he runs the numbers, he sees that it confirms his faith. But that gives him a sense of optimism about what is possible that I don't think even liberals and radicals, I mean, you mentioned the Marxist left today. That was true in Keynes's day, too. I mean, Keynes is constantly fighting with Marxists saying, like, no, we can do more. I mean, he has this huge battle with the socialist government of Britain in the early 1930s, where he's like, you need to run some big deficits. And they're like, no, that we can't afford it. We have to talk to JP Morgan in New York and work out an austerity plan with them so we can get a loan from the Americans. And Keynes is just pulling his hair out, like, no, run a deficit. And the socialists won't do it. They reject him. And I think his understanding about the greater possibilities that he gets from the war, which is a very negative sort of way of teaching that, teaches him that, you know, we could do this during peacetime too. We just have to have the courage to do it.
I think, to me, that's what makes this moment so sort of, you know, it's obviously been brutal. It's been a brutal moment personally. It's been a brutal moment for, you know, hundreds of thousands of families and tens of millions of households that have suffered. The only sort of hope I get is that, like, the intellectual terrain now feels more open than it's ever felt to me. Like, I just feel like I, you and I both sort of, I think, came of age at the kind of the twilight of the apex of a certain kind of neoliberalism, you know, financialization, globalization, market superalis, IMF structural adjustment, austerity, you know, incentives are everything. If you give people money, they won't want to work and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. This entire worldview that built the policy apparatus for several decades it still has its adherents who are powerful and it still has interests that are powerful, but it feels more intellectually destroyed than at any time in my life after financial crisis and COVID. And so it just seems to me like, I don't know, that religion has way fewer adherents and it feels like there's so much more open field to think about imagining a better world.
I think the financial crisis was a real, was the denouement for that era. I mean, first of all, the crisis couldn't have occurred had markets been rational, right? And self-correcting, it never would have happened. So that shocked a lot of people. And then, you know, it was very clear which countries did well and which countries didn't after the crash. It was the countries that spent a lot of money and ran big deficits that did well. And, you know, there are people who were still opposed to that for ideological reasons, but the people who were on board with the sort of high neoliberalism that you're talking about there were a lot of people who were on board with it because they thought it worked.
Yeah.
Right. And I think we forget about that when we cover politics so closely. I mean, I've been covering Washington for, you know, 10 years now. And, you know, oftentimes most of what happens in Washington happens because people don't agree about how things work. They have a different vision for society. At least that's what I think at the present moment. But there are a lot of people who are not politicians who think these things because they think they work. And when they see that they don't work, they do, in fact, change their minds. And so I don't think necessarily 2008, I think was the moment that really vindicated Keynes intellectually. I don't think people were quite ready to accept the sort of intellectual, political, and social kind of implications of that vindication. But I think in the coronavirus crash, I think you are. I mean, there are people on the right now who just are openly identify as Keynesians. That wasn't happening, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I dread the horrible austerity turn that we will get if Joe Biden is elected president. But I also feel like that turn is going to be easier to beat back than it was, you know, 12 years ago when you and I were covering the aftermath of the financial crisis. Zach Carter is a senior reporter at HuffPo. His award-winning biography of John Maynard Keynes, The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes, is out. You can get it on Audible. You can get it on your e-reader, or you can get it in print. And I would recommend absolutely reading it. It's a phenomenal book. He's an incredible figure. It's so well told. It's fascinating. It's sort of the best, most kind of enjoyable, entertaining, enriching biography genre that you can imagine. Zach, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Once again, my great thanks to Zach Carter, and honestly, my effusive praise for the book. I just want to reiterate, it's so, so good. We'd love to hear your feedback. Tweet us with the hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team and Kate Shaw, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to NBCNews.com/Why Is This Happening.